Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
This is the story of Walter Forrest Montgomery, BC's logging photographer. It was written by Estelle Noakes and is read by myself, Ed Campbell. The village of Chase was indeed fortunate when Walter Forrest Montgomery arrived in 1906 to make the community his home. There he resided, except for his war service years, until his death in 1969. He left behind a proud legacy, the product of his great skill in photographically depicting the various facets of the life and history of Chase and surrounding area. He was well known all over British Columbia as the logging photographer, leaving a magnificent visual record of the province's logging industry. His black and white prints reveal his fascination with the world around him. In addition to logging, his subjects included British Columbia's tallest trees, birds, animals, cowboys, farming, young bathers at Chase Beach. Walter Forrest Montgomery created a record unprecedented by any other itinerant photographer, documenting British Columbia's logging industry from its inception. His photographs span almost 60 years, showing the realism of logging in all its facets: cookhouses, wash day at camp, bunkhouses, and, of course, the loggers themselves. For many years, Montgomery was the official photographer for the Lumberman magazine. In addition, his photos were printed in Forest and Outdoor and Beaver magazines and in Canadian school texts. Walter Forrest Montgomery, known as Monty, was born in Sturton, Ontario, in 1879. As a small child, he moved with his family to the town of Guelph, Ontario. One of seven children, his upbringing was flavored by the Scottish culture and a strict Presbyterian faith. His father, John, was a cheesemaker at the Guelph Agricultural College and an elder in the Guelph Knox Kirk. Monty finished his schooling in Guelph and at 18 began an apprenticeship with Briggs Photographic Studio in Guelph. This was the beginning of a lifelong fascination with image making. He soon found studio work stuffy and limiting. His father suggested that he try his luck taking pictures on the farms, so he strapped his 6x8 camera and photographic equipment on his bicycle and left to solicit business in rural Ontario. Being a shy young man, it took great courage after pedaling for 35 miles to approach a farm and knock on the door. "What sort of contraption would that be ye have on your bike?" the farmer's wife would ask. After explaining what he was up to, perhaps she might agree to have her picture taken. He took pictures for the next 3 years on the farms of Ontario. Montgomery's life as a traveling picture man was just commencing. Ready for new adventures, Monty left Ontario, heading west in 1901. This was his first taste of the Wild West and the beginning of a new life filled with high adventure among shouting cowboys, rough logging crews, and chance encounters with grizzly, black bear, and moose. He traveled and worked through Manitoba and down to Montana, taking shots of the roundups and the rodeos. Traveling with another photographer, he jolted down rocky trails in a covered wagon, protecting his glass plates, enthralled with the scenery and the cowboy life. Journeying to Fernie in the East Kootenays, Monty worked for the Sandy McDougall logging camp. This was the beginning of an enchantment with logging and lumbering that would last a lifetime. Bunking in with the loggers, he shared their rough life. Montgomery spent 2 years in the Crow's Nest Pass area, which is where he earned the nickname Logging Photographer. His travels included winter trips by horse stage in sub-zero weather from Golden to Windermere. In summer, he made the same journey in Captain Blakely's boat, stopping to take pictures wherever he saw logging outfits or sawmills and developing his photos at night in his tent. Monty traveled from the Crow's Nest Pass all the way up to Prince George. He spent 3 autumns around Cochrane, Alberta, practicing his photographic style, capturing the action and daring of the cowboys. He shot the first rodeo to be held at Cochrane, where his prints sold for between $1 and $10. The ranches were always good for a meal and a bed. Once he made $75 selling his pictures at a ranch, a great deal of money for those times. Working for a studio in Calgary around 1904, he again found the work stifling and returned the next spring to what he enjoyed most, tramping the forests of British Columbia. He also traveled up and down the Kootenai and Okanagan Valleys, working for R.H. Truman Studios of Vancouver. In 1906, hearing about the openings of the Adam River Lumber Company, Montgomery arrived in the small village of Chase. Its location at the west end of Little Shuswap Lake amongst the hills appealed to him, and he decided to make the village his permanent headquarters. As a result of the mill, the area was booming, and by 1910, the new village boasted a hotel, hospital, general store, Chinese laundry, bank, cafes, and numerous businesses applying the agriculture and logging industries. In the evenings, Montgomery found his footsteps turning towards the Whitefield Chase Ranch. Every Saturday, the ranch house was filled with music from the family organ, and a violin or two would join in. It was here that Rebecca Monroe, granddaughter of Whitfield Chase, caught his eye. Known as Becky, she was a gentle, well-mannered girl of 18. The two shared their love of nature and the outdoors as they walked in the hills surrounding Chase. Monty grew quite fond of the young woman. In 1909, tragedy struck the village in the form of typhoid fever. Becky, through nursing her brother, contracted the disease and died at the age of 20. Montgomery joined her family and friends in mourning for her and for the loss of her cherished friendship. Every Sunday, when Montgomery was in residence at Chase, he would walk up to the graveyard overlooking the village and place a rose on Becky's grave. Now Montgomery is buried in the same graveyard, not too distant from his Becky. Although Monty was well-liked by women, he remained a bachelor. A proud Scot who loved Canada, Montgomery was one of the first to sign up when war was declared in 1914. Soon sent to the front lines, he spent 40 months in the trenches of France. Just before his discharge, he was severely injured. It was 3 long hours before he reached the operating room table, where 5 intestinal wounds were repaired. It took Montgomery a full year to recover, and his injuries were to plague him the rest of his life. He returned to Chase in late 1918 and slowly picked up the threads of his pre-war life, dusting off his camera and resuming his work of photography. In the following years, returning to the life he loved as a traveling picture man, he covered all of British Columbia, stopping to photograph the large logging outfits and sawmills. In the late 1920s, Montgomery spent 4 summers on Vancouver Island, intrigued by the immensity of the timber. His powerful photographs show man's ingenuity against the awesome panorama of British Columbia's forests. One of his prized possessions was a collection of BC's tallest trees, shot mostly on Vancouver Island. His trips usually lasted about 3 months, and then he would return to the village of Chase. The terrain Monty covered was difficult. Many times his life was endangered as he climbed to high, precarious places, carrying his heavy equipment. To take a picture from a particular angle was just the right amount of light. He narrowly escaped death from a wounded grizzly at Sulphur Creek. Black bears around Eliza Lake once added excitement to his wayfaring life, and a cow moose with a calf gave him a bad time when he tried to pass them on a trail near McBride. Monty's modes of travel were varied, but mostly he walked. Never owning a horse or car, he would often catch rides with camp supply trains or on ferries, barges, sternwheelers, and was even known to travel by covered wagon and stagecoach. The railway was a popular way to cover long distances. Considering the weighty and cumbersome equipment Monty packed on his travels, his photographs are remarkable. The camera, which he purchased in 1906 and never replaced, was 8x10 Seneca with lenses from Burke and James. In it were many parts he had fashioned himself. He used glass plates until 1921. Monty always developed and printed his own photos, never switching to color, although it was available and fashionable for a good part of his later career. He used any space he could find as a darkroom, even a tent. In 1940, at the age of 61, Montgomery saw duty again in World War II. After returning to Chase, he bought a house on Finn Flats, now Curry Flats, situated just below the main street of Chase near the railway tracks. The house was small, consisting of two rooms, with the kitchen doubling as a dark room. The walls of his home were lined with his many photographs. In his yard were fruit trees, berry bushes, a chicken house that occasionally housed chickens. There were also some large cedar trees under which many residents can remember having their pictures taken. To live his chosen life, Montgomery needed to live simply, and at times had to pull in his belt. His habit was to cook a large pot of oatmeal in the morning, enough for breakfast and his other two meals as well. To this, he would add whatever else he had on hand and wash it all down with strong tea. Although not a man inclined to look for physical labor, he did chop his own wood for exercise. In his leisure time, Montgomery would catch up on the reading he had missed while traveling. In his later years, after developing a keen interest in birds, he built birdhouses to surround his home. He liked the birds around for company. The birdhouses, like their maker, were quite unique, fashioned like little log homes. He used 1-inch tree limbs, which he would fit together and then paint. Entrances at either end with an inside divider allowed two bird families to use each house. One birdhouse of note was a replica of the school that Montgomery had attended as a boy. In the belfry was a wooden bell, similar to the one that called him to class. Many longtime residents of Chase have a Montgomery birdhouse in their possession, and one may be viewed at the Chase Museum. Although the logging industry was Montgomery's main focus, he often stopped to take pictures of nature. His innate patience and skill is demonstrated in his unusual photos of hummingbirds and wildlife in their natural habitat. Monty was also a familiar sight, shrouded under his black cloth, peering through the camera lens to take pictures of groups, weddings, school classes, and Legion affairs. It was a fun day for the school children when Monty arrived to take their yearly picture. Well-mannered, while he grouped them just so and readied his camera, they would break out in uncontainable laughter when he would throw back the cloth, pop up his head with his hair standing on end. The effect was all the more humorous because Montgomery was never purposely untidy. In fact, no one ever remembered seeing him wearing anything other than a suit, tie, and hat. The discipline needed to create such exceptional photographs was also apparent in Monty's daily routine. In fact, he was quite predictable. At precisely 9 p.m., he could be seen on the Chase boardwalks heading for the Underwood Hotel for his single pint. Known as a loner, he would choose a table by himself, never joining others. After this, he would often head for the Legion, where a crony or two would sometimes join him for some stronger spirits. Montgomery was a great supporter of the Legion and attended all the functions held there. On Robbie Burns' night, he would say the Scottish Grace in Gaelic. As a tribute, the Legion ladies designed a quilt dedicated to Walter Forrest Montgomery. Few people knew Montgomery well, and there is no evidence to suggest he ever returned home to visit Ontario. The only relative known to visit him was a niece from Alberta. He did not divulge personal information, and as one elderly resident said, "We were too busy to be curious. We didn't ask." He seldom approached others, but was always courteous when approached himself. Invitations to his home were not forthcoming, but when visited, he would offer tea in his gentlemanly way. Generous with his knowledge and talent, Montgomery was known to teach young people how to hand-tint black and white photos. Generous with the photographs, too, he gave away many of his best prints, leaving much of his work in the homes of Chase. With his view, camera, and artist's eye, he produced images of superb quality, excellent in detail, texture, and graduation of contrast. He never pressured anyone to purchase photographs, nor did he break trust by taking photographs that would cause anyone grief. He met all his assignments with accuracy and devotion. In an interview in 1955, Montgomery referred to the definition of photography as being the art of writing with light. Walter Forrest Montgomery used that light to leave us beautiful and instructive photographs, superb in meticulous detail and composition. He lived a bit separate and alone, as many artists do, with few material needs. He left behind the fruits of his labors, his masterpieces, which so clearly show the life and history of the early 1900s. In a 1959 interview, he said, "All in all, I've had a full life. I guess I'm the only one in BC who really made a lifelong profession of photographing the logging industry from the beginning." He died at the age of 90 in Vancouver Shaughnessy Hospital on September 23rd, 1969. The photographs of Walter Forrest Montgomery are stored in the BC Provincial Archives in Victoria, Kamloops, and in the Chase Museum and the North Shuswap Archives. The camera through which Montgomery practiced his art of writing with light can be viewed at the Chase Museum.
Why do they call it Revelstoke? Was first known as the Eddy because of the large swirl in the river here, then named Second Crossing, the first crossing of the Columbia River by the CPR being at Golden. The CPR named its station Revelstoke in honor of the first Lord Revelstoke, head of the British banking house that helped the CPR weather its last financial crisis during the construction of the railroad. Salmon Arm. The town takes its name from its location on the southwest arm of Shuswap Lake. Formerly, salmon were here in great numbers. Scotch Creek, named after Scottish prospectors who sought gold here in the 1860s. The Shuswap Indian word for this creek means small submerged area.
Melam stia, Wolf and Wolverine, Gokwalkin. Wai kukwalkum, Kenton Thomas Kiskwes. Kia az and sla az are Dr. Mary Thomas, Mark Thomas, Herbie and Virag Chani. Parents are Phyllis and Jerry Thomas. And my son is Susup Sewell. And we are all of Sequoyah and Silk descent. And this is the story of Melam stia, Wolf, and Wolverine, Gukwalkun. So a long, 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 long time ago, Wolf and Wolverine used to live together. And Wolf, he is a relative of Coyote, or the Trickster, or Seklep, or Skelep. And sometimes he's even known as Senghuluch. So Melam stia, he is known as a very good hunter, the wolf. But very little people know, Kelmuch, know that he is also a shaman, that he has very strong powers. And a long time ago, he lived with Wolverine. They lived together, Gukwalkin. Wolf hunted for the deer and the elk, while Gukwalkin, Wolverine, he liked to catch Skalaui, or beaver. Wolverine would set nets in the creeks near the beaver dams and the homes of the Skalaui. He broke the beavers' houses and dams and drove them into his nets, and that's where he would kill them. One day, Wolf said to Wolverine, Gukwalkin, I must leave you. For the game I hunt, all the deer and elk and anything else I might hunt has become very scarce around here. And I must go to some place where it is more plentiful. And Melam stia, he did just that. He went to a different part of the country where he found abundant elk and deer. He made a home, a nice lodge, and he hunted, killing so many of these animals that before long, he made his lodge hanging full of dried meat. Meanwhile, Skalaui, the beavers, had become very, very scarce where Wolverine lived. He had caught most of them, but he left a few remaining beaver. He lived for a long time on his dried beaver meat, but at last, all his dried beaver meat had dried up. He was reduced to starvation, and he became very thin. At this point, he decided to search for his friend Wolf, Melam stia, and to find out how he had fared, thinking, oh, he might have plenty of food. Soon he found Wolf's lodge, entered, and sat down near the door. He felt tired. Oh, he was so weak. And he said to himself, oh, Melam stia will see my plight, and he will feed me from his plentiful stores. Kukwalkin, Wolverine, saw that Wolf's house was hanging full of dried meat, back fat, and all forms of meat hanging. Wolf was there, but he didn't say one single word to Wolverine. Wolf proceeded to heat some stones and to boil some meat, which he ate. Then he emptied the brew right by Wolverine's face, out the door, and it hit the ground. Wolverine became very sad because Wolf offered him nothing and said to himself, oh, Melamstia has no pity on me when he sees me so lean and hungry, but even insults me by throwing out the nourishing brew right by my face. Well, Wolf shall find out that he is not the only shaman. I shall be even with him. Wolverine immediately left Wolf's house, and after traveling a considerable distance, he reached a lake where beavers were very plentiful. He caught many of the Skalaui, and before long, he had his lodge hanging full of their dried meat and of beaver tails tied in twos. Then, through his shamanistic powers, he made Wolf unlucky. Wolf could find very few deer, and when he did find any, he could not kill a single one. Wolf had to live on the stores of meat which he had laid up in his lodge. But at last he finished them all, and he was reduced to boiling the old bones and scraping the pieces of fat and meat off of the skins. Wolf ran out of scraps, and he thought of Wolverine, saying,
I will search for his house and live with him. Perhaps he has plenty of food.
Soon he found Wolverine's lodge, entered, and sat down at the door. Wolverine never said a single word, but proceeded to cook some beaver tails, and after eating them, he threw the brew right over Wolf's head, by his face, out the door, where it hit the ground. Wolf, Melamstia, at that point, remembered exactly how he had treated his friend Wolverine. And he said to himself,
he serves me as I served him.
He left, and ever since that day, Wolf and Wolverine have never, ever lived together again.
Why do they call it Seymour Arm? This and Seymour City at its north end were named after Frederick Seymour, governor of the Crown Colony of British Columbia from 1864 to 1869. Shuswap Lake, named after the Shuswap Indians who lived around it. Sycamose, a Shuswap Indian word meaning narrow, here applied to the channel between Shuswap Lake and Merrill Lake. Solsqua is the anglicization of the Shuswap Indian word meaning water. Sorrento, J.R. Kinghorn, who laid out the town site here, thought that the land looking toward Copper Island resembles Sorrento looking toward the Isle of Capri. For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season. Why do they call it Spalamshin? Derived from the Shuswap Indian word meaning flat area along the edge. Squilax, Shuswap Indian word meaning black bear. Tappan, George Tappan, not Tappan, a subcontractor laying track for the CPR, had a camp here in 1884. Turtle Valley, up here are found many painted turtles. White Lake, there is pronounced showing of lime on the bottom near the shore.
Well, I told the story on the Many Faces of Mount Ida. It's in there. of how our people settled in this area. Normally, we don't settle here. We didn't settle here because it was all bottom land but when the coming of the Indian agent and the government telling us that we had to settle on a reservation, and that's when we started, because our people were working for the railway at that time, cutting cordwood for the steam engines and ties for the railway, and they were working all around in this area. So when that's when the government came and started telling them, well, you got to start living somewhere on a reservation. So our people were working around the hills here and all camped all over, probably down by the lakes mostly. And when they were told that, so they moved over to Sandy Point, and they put up temporary winter houses there. But it was so cold with the north wind blowing that they feel they had to move somewhere else. So they moved down to the long near the river, Salmon River here. And that's when the log houses came in. They started building log houses for themselves. And that's when they actually moved over to where we are traditionally. And then when the settlers came, there was a lot of them up on the Glen Eden Bench, and so they kind of worked together. They shared with what needed to be done on their farms when they were land clearing. So our people started adapting to that way of life. When they came down, like if they needed a harness or something, and the farmers had some, so they'd work and trade with each other, whatever equipment or things that they needed to work the lands. Because at that time, our people didn't have full harnesses or even plows or anything like that. So they made agreements with the local farmers to help each other out. Kind of like a verbal agreement. They didn't like nowadays, you know, you got to sign a piece of paper saying, well, we're going to work with you. But at that time, you know, it was kind of a mutual agreement. And when the Finnish people moved up on the mount, up on the Glen Eden Bench, they started interacting with one another. And they were all assured of meat and fish and things like that. But they had the sugar, the salt, you know, the people started introduction of all those to our people. So they started trading with one another. And my grandmother had a root cellar out the back where she stored all her fish, her meats, and everything. And all the dried berries, everything. And then when the Finnish people come down to trade with us, she'd tell them, go in there and help yourself, you know what you want. So, and it was mutual trust. You know, they went in there and they took what they wanted and they left whatever they brought down. So it was, you know, it was enough for our people, you know, like coffee, tea, sugar, salt, milk, eggs, maybe, I don't know. But you know, she just told them, you go out there and help yourself. You know what you want. So there's always that sharing with other people. And one time my uncles were up there playing with the other young men up, the Finnish people, and they came back and they told my grandmother, said, oh, we're up there having a sauna. She asked him, what's that? He said, oh, it's like our sweat house. They go in this building and they build up sweat and they have a, it's what they call a sauna. She looked at him for a long time and she said, oh, they must be part Indian. That was the trade that went on, you know, the honesty and the sharing of two different cultures. And there's always that mutual respect for one another they had at that time. It still carried on till they finally all moved out of there. It's like all the disappearance of all our old people, you know. So we adapted to a newer way of life now where we have to go out and work. We don't hunt and gather like we did traditionally anymore. So it was coming of the changes at that time then. Our people were slowly adapting to the new way when they put us on these reserves. And so you could see they all kind of interact with one another of how we were, it was close to being assimilation, I guess you could call it, but I call it adaption to a new way of life. What I said was that the Creator gave this land, our people walked this land many, many years ago. They were given the job of looking after the land, and the animals were there too to teach them how to look after the land. This is all part of our early, early history. The Slakha'i, the ones that were handed down, the stories that were handed down to our people. And all the stories were actual stories of our people. And Chiptekula is the ones that were taught mostly, basically, to our younger people. Not only younger people, but to the younger adults, because, you know, you're never too young to learn. And these were constant reminders of our people how to act around each other, to respect one another, to honor one another. That's what Chiptekula is all about, because we always seem to forget about little things like that, honoring and respecting one another. So a lot of our Chiptekula is based around that. It teaches us how to act around one another. And one of our local one here is about Mount Ida, and it's about the little people. And it does have a real moral history to it. It tells of long time ago there was famine in the land. People were getting hungry. The babies were crying because they had no food to eat. And one day this hunter decided to go out hunting to look for some food for his family. He started walking and walking all over, maybe up Fly Hills, and somehow or another he made it up to Mount Ida. And that isn't the real name of our mountain up there, it's Glashant. So when he ended up on Glashant, he was so tired, I think probably from hunger, and so he laid down and he fell asleep. I don't know whether a noise or whatever kind of woke him up. And he sat up and he looked at all these little people around him. These little people asked him, "What are you doing on our mountain?" He said, "Well, my family is hungry. All our young people are starving." He said, "We have no food." And the little people told him, "You know why that is?" And the hunter said, "No." He said, "You have disrespected the land and our ways. You take and take and take and give nothing back in return. That's why you're being punished." So the hunter watched them disappear into the mountains. They sat there for a long time, and how do I give back in return? So that's when he decided to sweat and meditate for 4 days and four nights. So he built a sweat house and he stayed up there for 4 days and four nights. And as he was coming down from that mountain, he seen a big herd of deer all of a sudden. So he killed one of them and he brought back the heart and liver to the people to prove that there are, because Our people loved eating the liver raw, and the heart is the way of their culture. So when he presented this, he told them of what the little people told him. So since that day, a lot of our hunters, before they go out hunting, they'd go up on that mountain and fast for 4 days and four nights before they went out hunting. And this continued until probably around the late 1800s, when it kind of passed away because of the coming of the new settlers, and our ways are slowly disappearing then. I'm a Chiptakula, Mount Ida, Tlaskat. Yeah, because a lot of things have happened on that mountain, you know. And I remember that one time a lot of the people came to me when they were talking about the ski hill up there. They tried a ski hill up there. And some of the concerned citizens came to me and asked me my opinion, you know, whether I should go up there and protest or whatever. But I told them, well, if the little people want them up there, they'll accept them up there. Not up to me. Because the little people are more territorial, just like all native bands. You know, you can't come into my territory unless you get permission, or if you want the land, you got to fight me for it. The little people are like that. Because people were saying, oh yeah, the Sasquatches were on here. And I said, no, the little people, that's their territory. They'll fight for it. They'll fight the Sasquatch too. Because they have powers of doing different things, you know. They could make themselves big, I'm not too sure, but it sounds like it. They had powers that we don't fully understand. So, to me, they tell different ways of doing things, you know, because we keep taking and taking. Like I said, they didn't allow the ski hill up there. Then there were some logging issues going on, and the people from town came to me to try to help put a stop to it. And I said, no, it's up to the little people. It's their territory. I don't want to go up there. So the next thing you know, the fire came and burnt it all out, what they were arguing about. So that's when they approached us, and they talked about Sacred Circle up there and how to not protect the little people, but to make them aware that there is, because, you know, they have powers that we don't fully understand. So, because that's the way of our people a long time ago. And so a lot of the weird things have happened, you know, and I don't want to say it all. There's anger on that mountain. Weird things have happened. They done the logging up there. They had a couple of mysterious fires at their mills, and bad accidents, and as I always say, it's a work of the little people. People just laugh at me, but you know, I really believe it.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.